Goodniks explores the journey and meaning of doing good in the world.
I get to choose every day when I wake up whether I'm going to work for a Fortune 500 and make a ton of money or work for the movement that is the arc of moral justice.
But I realized that I also had an obligation to weaponize my privilege.
One day we said, okay, if the city's not going to do it, the state's not going to do it, if some large corporation's not going to do it, why not us?
And if there were enough of you, if you were organized enough, if you were loud enough, it would be too difficult for them to ignore you.
Goodniks, created by Jeff Leitner, hosted by Annalisa Enrile, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Mealy, I have two problems.
What are those?
I really love the show on professional development, and I've a big blank spot on my chest where my shirt is.
First of all, the first one doesn't sound like a problem.
I mean, it's so much love, I can't contain it.
And you also have what, a blank spot on your chest?
Yeah, where my shirt is.
You never grew chest hair?
Obviously not.
Oh, I know what you should do. You should go to this link in the show notes and get an unprofessional development t-shirt.
Gasp! That sounds like exactly what I needed for this premise.
So, boys and girls, we have t-shirts.
We have magnets. We have buttons.
Show your unprofessional love. That way you'll get to know who your fellow unprofessionals are when you're walking down the hallway and go, oh, you listen to that too?
Be an unprofessional representative. Welcome, friends, to a very historical episode of Unprofessional Development. I'm Tedisco.
And I'm Mealy. And today we have with us Coach Victor Hicks. You probably know him from Twitter or many other places, Coding with Culture. So we have him on here. I know him basically from Twitter. And he has a good balance of both getting into fun stuff as well as academic stuff, as well as, you know, all sorts of different roads. So a well-rounded guy. And so we have a good time on Twitter. And I was out there hunting up guests. And so and quite a few people said, hey, have him on. I said, okay. You've actually been on like my list and I hadn't gotten around to asking
my
you.
Popular so. Demand.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, I was always that student. I had to wonder, you know, when teachers were like, oh, I heard about you. You know, I was like, uh-huh. Okay, so you know,
yeah, then you gotta figure out what
it's part
it?
Of the course. I'll you know, you gotta take a little bit of the good with the bad, but it's all good. Well, thank you all for having me. I appreciate being
here. Yeah, you're doing good today.
I am. You know, I'm on uncle duty in a little bit, and you know, just living the life, enjoying the summer. It's actually, you know, for Georgia, it's relatively cool. We haven't, I'm fingers crossed, we haven't gotten into the you know, it's like once we break the 90s, then
I was gonna say we're in the Carolinas here, and I look next week is gonna be like 90 every
knew
day.
It. Well, the fact that we've got to June, what is it, 11th,
yeah,
and it's only 84 degrees today. I'll take that blessing.
Awesome. So we like to kind of get people's bios in a different way when we can. And so this is just my little weird prompt that I've got today. So describe your journey into the world of education as a patchwork quilt. So what are the different pieces that you've accumulated and sewed together as you've developed your education, you know, quilt?
Okay. You know, and I think that would probably be a good analogy, because literally it has been just that. It's been a, you know, a piece of this and a piece of that. But, you know, it's all really ended up, thankfully, half of my quilt, you know, started, I think, when education still was, you know, relatively, I guess, not in, and I would say makes sense. So grew up in a family of educators. So my mom taught for 30 years, both my aunts. So grew up in a house, you know, where education and being educators was always valued. So the first patch would be probably working my Park District shirt from Chicago. That's kind of where the, you know, the journey began as a day camp counselor, and
there you go.
Worked around, you know, went on to school, of course, at Clark Atlanta. So there'll definitely be the HBCU, probably a couple patches in there, depending on which area we were focusing on. Uh-huh. And then the coaching of the STEP teams there, which was the other half of Coding with Culture, other half of the HBCU ready experience. And then pretty much the subject matter. So I've done, you know, Title I reading interventionalist. I've done first grade, preschool, PE, dance, computer science. So, you know, some, I like to feel like I'm a t-shirt guy. Coaches tend to be t-shirt people by definition. So I would probably say the associated t-shirt with each of those teams. Mm-hmm. Oh, and all-star cheerleading coach.
Okay. Wow. But
yeah. Yeah. Awesome. There's my quilt.
You get bored a lot.
Listen. And then when I'm not with other people, then I have my nieces and nephews. So then there's the Uncle Victor piece of the quilt. So yeah, I'm always bored. Can't you tell? A whole lot of time to rest.
There we go.
Nice.
Excellent.
So you and Mealy at this point have both mentioned coding with culture. I assume you're making computer programs with different languages. But in case I'm wrong, give me the pitch for coding with culture.
So coding with culture pretty much incorporates a project-based learning experience on one arm. So let me start off by saying that it actually has two different arms right now.
Me too.
Hey, listen, all the commonalities. But yeah, it came from
not right that surfer the- with the shark that got
no
one and a half.
He simplified.
See, I have okay. Yeah.
Come for the pedagogy, stay for the amputee humor. Okay.
Right. Okay. Lord have mercy. Okay.
Give him a hand.
Oh, God.
So we went to, we started off during the pandemic with our online computer science classes. I was, you know, teaching it as an after-school program. And then throughout the summer, I had quite a few parents that asked, you know, said the kids really enjoyed the coding online. It was one of the subjects that thankfully transferred over. So
yeah,
always talk kind of with the HBCU and, you know, culturally relevant piece to all the subjects I've had the opportunity to teach. But when we worked into the during the pandemic, I realized we needed bigger chunks instead of just kind of because we don't have the day-to-day face-to-face. So I kind of applied, you know, project-based learning from there, and then that transferred over into the summer camp. So the kids do some hands-on STEM activities. We do engineering, design, coding, depending on the age group, because we do have students from K through 12. So we do, of course, the Blockly, the Scratch at first, a little bit of code.org for the instructional piece, the how-to. And then pretty much the high school kids, I would say theirs are more, I've tended to have more than, like the one-on-one camps. So that's the other part of the instructional piece. We have the one-on-one camps. The majority of my high school kids have been that. So I've done the Python. I've done the JavaScript, a little bit of C++, not too much. I haven't really had too much, too many kids asking for that. Usually what happens is it's whatever they're taking in, you know, whatever pathway their school offers. Mm-hmm. Recently got into EarSketch, which is a really cool program with Georgia Tech. So the kids, the cool thing with that is it's the same curriculum, but the kids can choose Java or Python. So that way they can see kind of what I've done with that with our camps is do it one by one. And then the second arm is just the teachers. So we've done, recently been fortunate enough to do a couple speaking engagements, trying to, you know, teach the importance of computer science and giving teachers some practical ways to incorporate it into their classroom. Because again, I wasn't a computer science teacher by trade. So a lot of what I learned best practices was kind of trial by error. You know, but and the great part about that is that really, really came across some great resources, especially for the younger kids. Now that tends to be where teachers tend to struggle. So have had the opportunity to pass that message on with some really great organizations. And, you know, it's been great. So we're organic. It's just me. So, you know, I feel like tomorrow we could be a roller skating school. You know, hey, it depends.
I was going to say, So the coding part, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. So tell us how the culture weaves into the coding part and what that looks like.
So usually, like I said, so it goes back to the big kind of crux of our club or organization for both the teachers and the students are the project-based learning pieces. Okay. So really kind of making coding meaningful for kids. So mm-hmm. How the culture kind of does it is it gives them two things, you know, because one of the, I think we hear a lot about in STEM and computer science is, you know, if they need to or see it to be it, I think is the way the phrase goes.
Right.
So it's one way to me kind of take the field trippiness out of giving kids, you know, exposure. So why are you showing me this 20-minute video about a graphic designer? But if we can take some practical pieces and figure out ways to tie in the culture into the actual projects,
okay.
I see that tends to be a little bit more substantial with the kids. But then too, I think, you know, that's always been one of the things I've noticed with computer science, especially seeing it from the K-8 spectrum, is that so much of it, and I'm glad, you know, to get the kind of get the fire ignited and get the younger kids wanting to code, but it wasn't very real life. So when mm-hmm. you started having kids going to sixth grade and you set them down and you're like, okay, now you got to start debugging JavaScript, and it's no longer moving the angry bird across the screen.
Right.
You know, so one of the ways I felt it's, I've seen it's been most effective, I guess, to kind of introduce, you know, to bridge the gap is through those project-based learning. So I kind of, you know, killed two birds with one stone, so to speak, and infuse the culture piece in there too, so they get that extra bonus.
So in, so the projects are, have the culture in them and say, hey, I want you to like make something that's related to this, or, you know, and do the kids have some like agency or autonomy where they go, or do they, or, is it, or do you give them like, hey, here's like three or four things that I think I've seen done in the past that maybe you'd like to do, or how's that go?
Well, you know, and it's interesting enough. One of the things as a as an educator where I challenge myself this year is to give them a little bit more of the autonomy. I will kind of give them the gaps. So like one of the things we did, the kids had to present a they do their Minecraft activity where they have to create, they design an HBCU. So there's a 3D modeling piece, of course, with the Minecraft. We tie in math, but I don't let them, or I kind of, this was the last time I did it, virtually, or we did it, so the kids got to choose how they did the project. So if they wanted to go build their entire school from scratch, if they wanted to, you know, and what they ended up doing was coming together and deciding everybody took a chunk of the campus. So I think it gave them a more realistic, because I think one of the things, one of the big faux pas we make in education, we tell kids like, well, you have to work together. Well, that is actually a very, very abstract concept, especially for an 8 year old. So it's like, okay, this is
what,
like,
I just heard is I need to copy off of the guy next to me.
Well, I mean, you know, and it was weird because I think that was one of the things, because, you know, I tried not to buy into the, you know, the buzzwords like learning loss, but I think what was most noticeable and significant when I did get those kids back, you know, even in the virtual space, was that the soft skills really were struggling. That was the area, you know, and it was like, so, okay, so now I have to literally, like, even with my 13-year-olds this year, model what working together looks like, but also giving them enough room. So again, for example, when they did, you know, that level, I mean, excuse me, that project, and, you know, we chose a group of friends that are, you know, my homies, and yeah, we have a great time. Well, yeah. And then when Miss Jix is looking at you the day that it's due and it's not done, you know, you get the very realistic lesson that, again, more than I could ever teach you by, you know, spinning the wheel and randomly picking partners. No, you, because when you go work for Microsoft or Google or all these wonderful places, hopefully I'm preparing you to work for, so Mr. Hicks can retire and you can take care of me. Right. You know, I think that they need to, you know, but they have to know that that is much more valuable lesson than, you know, me being the, and, you know, the dictator, so to speak, over the project. So yeah, I think the autonomy is important, is a huge piece, but it's something you have to get more comfortable with, I think, too, as an educator. Because if you're, you know, kids smell fear sometimes better than animals. So, you know, if you're so if you're honestly not in that place now where you're like, okay, I got it, I'm cool with letting them, like, because if you're gonna be screaming your head off every day, just, you know,
I definitely do. As someone who has done more and more projects every year, I would definitely recommend go in the shallow end first for something that you can knock out in a day and see what you feel about it before you take on some massive, like, week long thing. And you realize, like, 2 days into it that, like, that learning isn't happening the way you want it to be happening. And if you're not clear where it's that balancing act. I always use this analogy that so much of teaching is like teaching a kid to ride a bike, and you have to know when to hold on to the seat, when to hold on to the seat and the handlebars, when to let go of the seat, let them crash, you know, when to, like, say, hey, watch me and see what I'm doing one time, and I'm going to ride the bike in a circle, and you're going to notice, and I'm going to kind of talk you through what I'm doing, and all those little things. And sometimes you have to go, okay, and you have to know when to stop and when to start, and kind of, and it's a feel thing that you kind of, like, that you learn as you do it more. But the more you get, but I think that doing project-based learning is addictive once you get into it, because
once
you see, like, the results, you know, and, like, and sometimes it's a big chunk, sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's just like one kid, like, that does something that you're like, oh my god, that's beyond my wildest dreams of what I anticipated. And even if, like, these five over here, like, did the bare minimum, this guy here made my whole stinking week. So yeah.
But I think it's more real life. You know, we're not really, you know, I think we have to be realistic. You know, and again, one of the best things I've heard in conversation with fellow educators is that we are in the midst of, or we're in the process, or the continued process or practice of educating children to fit the Industrial Revolution model, right? We needed several people that could do a menial task for 8 hours, you know, on demand, be on to kind of fit these things. Well, we say a lot, and I think one of the other benefits, if there was one, of the pandemic was it was the jolt. Like, I'm pretty sure when they transitioned from one room schoolhouses into the K-8 model, those first years it was probably very hard to conceptualize and internalize and digest that form of education. But project-based learning is what the kids will never go, and I would say never, but into many jobs right now. And definitely we look at the job forecast in the next 10 or 20 years, even the few menial tasks that are left, you know what I'm saying? If you want to take it into the realm of computer science, so the actual typing out or the syntax of coding is going to be automated. With the rise of machine learning and AI, these tasks that, again, could fill kind of the masses when we were in that industrial, and I hate these because I know that was a long span, but I'm just thinking of milestones, like when it started. That Industrial Revolution model of education, those jobs simply will not exist anymore. Right. So it's like you have to be able to collaborate. And again, not the collaboration, you know, we were doing 10,000 years ago when Coach Hicks was in elementary school, because you, like, it no longer can be, well, she doesn't know how to work with other people, you know, or she doesn't, because what's she going to do? You know, what's going to happen?
Right.
So I think that is, you know, it's project-based learning has to become, if we're going to educate children responsibly. And I think that was one of the things I was disappointed with after the pandemic, is that we kept saying, you know, it's time to make a change. And I think, you know, we found some ways to do that. But then we got, and I don't know what happened, but it's like we got back and they were like, okay, let's go back to the status quo. Like,
well, the districts went out and bought these learning management systems that could just deliver, like, that basically became like the new version of a textbook, where the teachers could just deliver module after module. And, you know, instead of the questions in the back of the textbook, it's now just the questions at the end of the, instead they're going to watch like a 4-minute video and then they're going to do these questions or whatever it is. And it's, and, you know, or things that are, pretending to be project-based, which are really, you know, it's just, you know, virtual, glue sticks and glitter.
and sure, teachers whine that it's unethical to teach that way, but counterpoint, it was expensive to buy.
It was.
So
the district spent a lot of time on it. So I should just sit back and let the kids ride that ride while I do nothing.
What's the worst that could happen?
I mean,
okay.
I feel you seething.
You know,
he's like, should I turn on the spigot and let the fire hydrant just go, or should I just cut it off and not rant? Because I feel like there's a rant that you could just rant along with us,
you know, I've learned, I've tried to be, and I would say I've, you know, as. And I, you know, I'm sure sometimes my Twitter personality, I tell people, no, you guys have gotten 40-year-old Victor. There was a 20-year-old Victor that many of my frat brothers and college friends met that, you know, it's, let me say, it has been a bear. I'm proud of growth.
Good.
That's what we'll call them. I'm proud of growth. There, so, you know, there, but you sometimes, you know, I could say a lot about a lot, but sometimes you learn, you know, a few there things about a little are a lot more.
I know your two big passions are coding with culture, and I also know that you're very passionate for the HBCUs. So where do you see, you know, the progression of that? How do you see the success stories leading along, and how do you see HBCUs, you know, sort of helping or guiding students and culture as we go?
Well, I think, you know, definitely, fortunately, I'm kind of through the cycle now where we are so my first group of kindergartners that have kind of gone through the different phases of what Coding with Culture, as was one Sci-Fi Beta Step Team, but it is now they're actually going to college. Many of them are choosing HBCUs. diverse group of students choosing HBCUs, which I'm very, very awesome. Proud of to hear. But, you know, even the ones who did not, I'm very, very proud to say that they had that piece of knowledge so that whatever school choice they made, it was a knowledgeable one. So it wasn't because we did not know. But as again, I told my students, as long as you can come to Coach Hicks with a plan to be successful, you know, I'm with it. I will always be your coach and definitely, you know, one of your biggest cheerleaders. But I think the significance that they play is just that, because, you know, HBCUs offer so much more than just the Black culture piece, which of course is paramount and very, very important. But as an educator, it provides such a support system. And I know I've taught Caucasian students who succeeded because Coach Hicks taught like an HBCU educator. And so again, if that student is going to benefit from having professors, some of those characteristics that are, you know, at the core of what HBCUs are about, then and by all means, that's where, again, when we talk about school choice, you know, I want you to go someplace where if you're going to spend and invest all that money, I want you to go someplace where you're going to be successful. And what I find is that, again, now that's, is it for every student that I teach? Absolutely not. But there are several kids, again, and they've in the now almost 20 years, goodness, that I've, you know, that I've been teaching. It really has gotten to a point now where they are, you know, they are, I'm seeing the kind of the range of, you know, what everybody's done and what they're choosing. And, you know, it I think they provide that environment that has been successful, you know, and I think the reason I'm able to kind of do what I do and pour in, into my students what I pour is definitely because the education piece came from an HBCU. I think it's important because, again, a lot of the misconceptions, as, you know, my recent debacle with my school point out, you know, it just, there's a lot of misconceptions about what they are. You know, they mm-hmm. were, you know, again, schools that offered education to African-Americans when there was no other choice. Right. So, you know, that is the historical in historical Black colleges. So I think we need to realize where they're not, you know, going to be as diverse. And again, I think that's important because you have schools or students where that type of environment works best for them. Now, I don't have any student that is not African-American that has ever been turned away or went to an HBCU and felt like they were not mm-hmm. welcome. But again,
oh, I'm reaching for the name now. Oh God, what's this? Okay. I want to think of the character's name on Different World, but I don't know what is.
Oh, Maggie, is. When Marissa Tomei.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. There we go. Yep. No, there was a boy too.
Oh, Freddie's cousin, Freddie's Matt.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Freddie's cousin, Matt.
It's basically Different World is basically a documentary about HBCUs, if you didn't know that, Tedesco.
I did not.
So now, wait a minute. Hold on. You got on a call with Coach Hicks and you did not do. Now, A Different World is the paramount. So you need to, after we get off this call, go. It's on, if you have Amazon.
Yes.
It's free. Yeah.
Have you not watched it, Tedesco?
No, never even heard of it.
Oh, my goodness. So it is. Oh, wow.
Oh, okay.
Basically, I watched it because I had a crush on Lisa Bonet. So that's that. Let's start there. But anyway, it is the spinoff from Cosby Show. And so when she goes to college, but it's really, really good. And they hit a lot of good issues, and it's really funny. And in general, it's well done. I'm not a huge Sinbad fan actually, but other than
I think, yeah, but see now, you know, there's a lot of, a lot of culture around whether or not, you know, people didn't like season one was like the one that everybody kind of likes. So yeah, it definitely got, I think it got better with time.
Yeah. Yeah. And they kind of found their place and who was, you know, really became more, you know, Dwayne, Wayne and
Whitley.
Yeah. Yeah. Whitley, their dynamic. I need to go back and rewatch it because it's been a while.
Interesting story though. You know, I think, and what the significant change was when Debbie Allen came on board, because, you know, one of the biggest criticisms was that, you know, Bill Cosby didn't go to an HBCU.
Okay. Yeah.
And so you had this show and literally, he was calling it an HBCU, but, you know, just even from the cast and just, I mean, even with the extras and some of the storylines, there wasn't a lot of reality. So the story goes, you know, because of course his TV wife is Debbie Allen's sister. So she went to, and apparently she kind of pulled his coattails and was like, Bill, you're going to make a lot of HBCU folks mad. Like, you need to get Debbie. And then once Debbie came, the show kind of hit its trajectory. Because yeah, its ratings were very low.
Yeah.
First season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say, but I recently listened to a podcast, Freakonomics, and they're just going all through the whole college what is college? Why should college? What should college look like? And all that kind of stuff. And after you get away from this teeny tiny, like small percent, the Harvards, the MITs and the Stanfords, which is like 5% of like people that are educated, the success rate of HBCUs versus everybody else outside the MITs and Harvards, you know what I mean, is astronomical. They blow away the state schools and the community colleges and the private schools and all the other things that you look at in terms of like the success rate of their students and the graduation rate and all these kind of things. So having not gone to one either and only knowing like that little piece, like I know from that podcast and from Different World, what would you say is at the core of what HBCUs are doing that has their students be successful?
I think it's, again, it kind of go, well, I guess it would be a play off of the, you know, if you need to see it, you need to see it, because I know that was a huge part of my success, you know, coming from a predominantly white school in Chicago, mm-hmm. Catholic school in Chicago, ironically enough, mm-hmm. As I should have learned my lesson, right? Woo. But anyway, so see, there you go. So there, that's my, see, well, I tell you, just every once in a while.
Well, yes.
So they,
if you know, you know, listeners.
Hey, follow, stay tuned. But no, they, I think, you know, they really, and again, one of the things was definitely the amount of role models and mentors and people mm-hmm. that were really there to help me succeed. But also, I think it was the fact that it was that small college environment. And I mean, right. even some of my friends that went to schools that were comparable sizes of historically Black colleges, they didn't have that same experience. I mean, right. and to the point, like when I was missing my classes, I remember talking to one of my friends on the phone who's at the University of Illinois, and he's like, you're in college now. Like, the teachers don't care if you come, like, because right. of course he's in that's class why, with 3,000, you know,
yeah, that's why
freshmen.
That's why I flunked out of college the first time.
So when I came back, so I'm like, oh, okay, cool. I had 8 o'clock class. I didn't go for like 2 weeks. I thought I was good. My mm-hmm. professor, I will never forget, came to my dorm, wow. knocked on the door. And so interestingly enough, she was in the same sorority as my mom is in. So she's like, oh, and I've already called your mom. Oh. Of course, there's no cell phone, so she couldn't have my mom on the phone.
Right.
Oh. But that, I feel like that anticipation was kept a lot worse, because she's like, oh, yeah, no, I told your mother. And she literally called my mom and calculated to the credit hour how much of her money I had wasted.
Oh, and wow. Goodness.
Unbeknownst to my professor, well, at least I don't think she knew, my mother is an eighth grade math teacher. So, of course, that uh-huh. conversation, But all that Oof. To say, those were the things that I didn't know I needed, but definitely in that environment, you know what I'm saying, moving away from home, being 18, being absolutely green, coming from a small Catholic prep school, basically, you know. Mm-hmm. But again, so it provided the grounding, and I think, like I said, the mentoring and the role models and the, you know, yeah. the yeah. opportunities. Right, yeah. But I think, like I said, there was an amazing amount of excellent pedagogy. And I think that's what people, again, why I don't mind recommending HBCUs to my diverse group of students.
So do you think that the culture, the community aspect of it, do you think that the in-classroom experience is significantly different as well?
I think it's more culturally responsive in a case. I think, but even within that, I think one of the things that was valuable about the HBCU experience is that there was still a diversity across instructional styles, which mm-hmm. again is a very real life thing. So I had professors who were absolutely harsh and did not play, didn't care if you were dead down the street, like you better roll up in here with that coffin and your assignment at 12 o'clock or you, right. you know. But I also had the ones who stepped into the more parental role, like that, the professor I just mentioned. But again, mm-hmm. she was my advisor. So we had that type of relationship. So again, that yin and yang that you're supposed to get in college, I definitely got that. So I don't, you know, what everybody wasn't, you know, cooking Sunday dinner and inviting every kid over. It was, you know,
right.
you got your behinds handed to you sometimes. Right. And then, right. you know, but I definitely think there was a sense of everyone there wanted you to succeed. And I think right. that was the question. Like I said, in today's world, one of the reasons I think in the, you know, craziness that we're living in is that I think it's more important now than ever, because you already have kids that are feeling and seeing and exposed to too much by eighth grade. You know what I'm saying? Because of social media, because of the craziness with politics and the world and all that foolishness. But they need, if you're going to get in college, is one of the most critical times of your life, if also one of the most expensive. So I need, if you're going to make that investment, everybody from the person cleaning your dorm to the president of the university, you don't have to question if they want you to succeed.
Right. And I was going to say there's I'm sure there is an attitude of, hey, we know we live in a white world, you know, in general. So when you get out there and you're going to apply and they see, you know, such and such, you know, university, we want to make sure that the ones that come from here are going to kick butt when they get in the world.
Oh, yeah. Because
they're already going in with like when, you know, Johnny White guy is like at the thing and he sees, oh, you went to like, and he knows it's an HBCU for whatever, you know, for however he figured that out, he's going to be like, oh. And so I'm assuming that they have to up their level because they know it's that whole, you got to like prove it a little more than like the guy that went to the, you know, the Georgia Tech or the, or Georgia or Carolina or Alabama or whatever, you know, Penn State, whatever you want to, you know, colleges that have that kind of like, you know, general reputation.
Yeah. And I think that, but that was one of the things that, because one of my, you know, once the iron is sharpened, it's sharpened. So, you know, for whatever that stone that you're using, you know, that you have to sharpen. I mean, it's maybe not desirable or unfortunate, but at the end of that experience, you are still, you know, sharp and on point. I think that was one of the things when I saw with my counterparts that did attend some of the, you know, the more majority institutions, so to speak, is that when it came to interviewing, we fought because excellence was the expectation. I, you know, from the biggest HBCU to the smallest, like that was a standard that, again, something I want for my students after they leave me, because Mr. Hicks doesn't play with them either. So, you know, I want you to go out there. Yes, you have to be considered. And again, is it fair? No. Is it ideal? No. But if I want the best for you, I know that this place will prepare you, because you're absolutely right. By their very inception, you know what I'm saying? There was inequality, which is why they had to be founded in the first place to fill that need. So,
yeah, I also imagine that founding is part of that culture too. Cause I mean, if you think about a lot of traditional colleges and universities, like a lot of them, like the core of them historically has been, who's the best lawyer here? Who's the best doctor here? Students constantly in competition to see who's the best, while HBCUs were built to build up people, you know, and help people reach their full potential. And so I have to imagine that philosophy, that mission statement, I know you're a big fan of mission statements, that mission statement, you know, has to help.
Yeah. And I think that is the great balance in HBCUs, because there is a hold on, you know, that traditional piece. And I think that is in the foundation of all of them. But then coupled with, okay, well, we still have to be prepared for you to participate and to compete. Right. You know, in today's world. So I think it's that, you know, like I said, the right amount of mixture of tough love and history. And, you know, again, we are putting you through this rigor, so to speak, not to use our other buzzword, but, you know, they are, I think that it is that, you know what I mean? And that's why I said it is because we know that this was the perception. And so we're going to continue to push you to be excellent, because again, worst case scenario, you're going to be good to go. You're going to be prepared for, you know, to compete. And I think that's what they all do a good job of doing. And I think even too, though, there are different environments even within HBCU. So you do have larger ones that provide more of that, you know what I'm saying? It's now still historical, because I think that piece will always be there. But there is a more definite, I guess, vibe, energy of more kind of like, okay, you know, but then you also have your, you know, but again, even like with, I think, some of the more, you know, the larger institutions, your small private schools, so your Agnes Scotts, your, you know, Wellesleys are going to have a different feeling, because it is single gender and it is only so many students. And I think you'll find that too in some of the HBCUs. So you have your Howards, your, you know, FAM, your Florida A&Ms, your, where they're bigger. Right. They are kind of in the national spotlight right now. I mean, thankfully so many HBCUs are, but you know, those schools are going to give you more of the Penn States, and that kind of, okay, you need to be the, like, because we do have a medical school, so we're still expecting you to do X, Y, and Z, but then you also have your smaller ones, you know, mirroring the more rural institutions where, yeah, it's excellence, but we're not, it's a little bit more about, hey, let's all, we're a family. Right. And it's,
I was going to say that you can have both high level of accountability and a lot of support just because, you're giving someone support and doing what, like, she was, that advisor that came to you, she was giving you a lot of support, but she wasn't babying you. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so there's and finding that balance, because someone's like, oh, well, you know, we got to expect them. And if they don't come to 8 o'clock class and they don't come, that's how they're going to learn to be a grown up. Well, they can learn to be a grown up by you actually coming and giving
an adult conversation with them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's treating people like humans is a really revolutionary idea for a lot of educators.
Yep.
Yeah. And there's someone else, you're like, oh, I've got to teach them how to, it's like, you're not teaching them anything, but you're trying to teach them that people are mean and cruel and insensitive. Like, good job there. Like,
I've never understood that concept with the benefit of, like, all right, let's teach kids that people are mean. Like, they, trust me, that will be a lesson that.
Yes.
I know, with teenagers all day, they figured that out.
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely.
They will learn a lesson when I fail them. Yeah. Well, what lesson did they learn?
Yes, because before that, they've never experienced failure.
Right. Yes, devastation of zero and how it's mathematically impossible. Like, that's a whole different conversation.
Oh, man, I'm a 50 evangelist, and I have that conversation way too many times. Are we looking at, like, heading out now? What's your ETA here?
I think about three. Oh, they're probably pulling up in the next couple of minutes.
Okay.
I got a couple seconds.
Okay, cool. So we always like to end with funny stories. So if you got a funny anecdote or a goofy story from coding with culture or whatever, that you can just go, this is my go-to.
Oh my goodness. Well, my children. Well, I think, and I'm sure that every teacher has the same issue, but I have students. I'm convinced my kids, usually my children that are involved with after school programs, it's the ones that are with me all the time, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being a single teacher, they are now, female single teachers, I feel, are okay. They feel like, you know, this is my teacher. She's on point. As a male single teacher, we are not given that same respect. So I remember I had a student, and I had babies. So they might have been about first or second grade. Mm-hmm. And I think it was one of my, I think it was cheer. It might have been cheer. Maybe step. No, it was step. It was step. And so I, again, you know, went and got food at between my last period class and practice. Of course, you know, teachers don't get to eat. So, you know, I think there was a McDonald's down the street from the school. So I'm thinking, harmlessly enough, I come back into my office, I'm, you know, eating. And so, of course, by this time the bell rings, the kids are coming into practice. So I'm finishing up, and one of my kids, I think it was the shade behind, because it was like one of those moments, like, I think my friend is having a crisis. I need to, and I don't want to embarrass him. So she goes, Miss Chicks, I think you need to get married. And I said, okay, not a hello, not okay. Yeah. I said, but pray tell, humor me. What do I need? Why does Miss Chicks? She says, because you know all that McDonald's is not good for you, and I know that I noticed that you order lunch out a lot. Maybe if you got married, someone will be able to help you and cook for you. And then walked away. Just
wow.
Nice.
It's so funny when there are
six years old. Say,
a 65-year-old lady that is living inside this 6-year-old. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Basically.
Yes.
It's like she's courting grandma, but she's doing it at six.
In my first year teaching, I was, you know, a single teacher, and one of the students I was teaching in eighth grade, and one of my students was talking to another teacher on my team. They're like, man, Mr. Tedesco needs a dog. And the teacher on my team is like, why? She goes, because he works too much. He's here 12 hours a day. He stays until 8 o'clock at night. First year teaching. It's like, so he needs something to go home to. He just needs a dog.
He needs something to do. That. Well,
yeah.
And
the other teacher on my team was like, yeah, or he could get a girlfriend. And then there was a long pause. And she goes, yeah, he needs a dog.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, middle school cuts deep. And so, like I said, besides being the, a teacher, I'm also the uncle to many nieces. Actually, my nieces outnumber my nephews, and it's brutal. My niece Charlie came to, she was one of my first Coding with Culture students, and she got on a on one of our Zoom calls. Mm-hmm. And she says, so she's saying, as usual, again, at this point, she's maybe about five. So, you know, my nephew Carson is very excited. So he's Uncle Victor, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's my rule follower, of course. Mm-hmm. She's sitting here with her legs and arms folded. And I said, okay, well, are you going, you know, are you going to join us? You know, actually maybe learn, because you're actually the youngest of this group. So you probably need to be. And she said, Uncle Victor, what time did you wake up this morning? And I said, well, if it's any of your business, I mean, you know, normal time. Why? She goes, you look sleepy. I think you need another cup of coffee. I said, okay, well, at that point, I feel foolish having asking this 70-year-old person, exactly, you hit the nail on the head, to do Angry Birds coding, because clearly she got my entire life together these last 2 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, yes, the children, funny lesson of the day, children are brutal.
They are. They're
brutally honest. Yes.
One was like pointing out my my dandruff this year. She's like, you need like a different shampoo. I'm like, I appreciate that. So like, and like,
yep.
I, and that was nice, because I'm like, there was a part of me who would say, oh, just so you know, you look way better with your mask on than you do with your mask off. So,
But see, that's what I love about high school. See, high school, you can play the dozen. See, but I tell my children, I'm teaching now in the summer. I'm like, now let me tell you something. I said, now the babies, I feel like they cannot, they need, you know, I got to make sure that they're, you know, not, I said, oh no, baby, you're 16, 17 years old. Mm-mm. Yeah. I said, just be careful.
If you start swinging, I'm going to swing back.
But see, that's what I love. See, I definitely, I mean, I love all of my babies, but I am definitely the teenage uncle. I'm like, when you can get, I said, when I don't have to work, you don't have any money? Okay, nope. You're going to learn today. Yeah, my oldest nephew came this into, was here for a basketball tournament. And I was like, oh, no, this is very different. The auntie shuffle does all the spoiling. I said, you a grown ass man. You going to sit here. I said, no, you need to be paying for Uncle Victor's meal. That's what you need to be doing for all the years of stress.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
But yeah, awesome. They're a good group. So
they are. All right. Well, first of all, thank you again. We know we had some scheduling snafus. We're glad to have gotten you here. Yeah. And love you. And for those of you who do know his situation or want to know more about his situation, hit him on Twitter and DM him. And I know you're going to bounce back, and I know I'm looking forward to what the next chapter is, because it's going to be awesome.
Thank you so much.
And I mean, just people.
It's going to be a great part of the biopic that people, they're going to make about.
I was going to say people are stupid.
The thing of it is, like I said, with anything, you know, sometimes we don't see, and I know that I, as an educator, you know, we are at fault sometimes loyal mm-hmm. to our kids. You know, all environments are not for everyone. And, you know, for things to, I'm like, it was just, to me, it was, because I know I wouldn't have left, voluntarily.
Right.
And, yeah. But clearly by the play of events, that was not a safe environment. Coding with, but again, that, which is part of my kind of bewilderment, because it's like, anybody that knows Victor Hicks knows he is a, so if there was ever any negative feeling towards about sideways, maybe on Thursday, you thought, and I offered that in the first conversation, but
yeah, you weren't like trying to sneak something by them or doing it on the down low.
In my teacher portfolio, there is my Bitmoji with an HBCU sweatshirt on. So,
I mean, that could mean anything.
No, it actually had the logos of the HBCU. That's how extra I am. So,
yeah.
Again, like I tell people, I'm not everybody's cup of tea.
When they walk into your classroom or workspace or whatever, that it's not invisible there either, right?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, but again, if I'm coming in to provide this, you know, in their words, this, you know, safe space for this group of students that you felt has felt invisible, and you know, you've had issues, and that's a whole different, you know, horse of a different color. But again, I've created it. Now this is, it's, and they're flourishing and you're seeing all these things, but that's not, you know, again, I think you just, you know, we wanted to stop at surveys, and, you know, I can say I'm doing the work, but not too much work, you know, do the work, but the way I tell, and I'm like, that in itself is so
not cool. Do you not understand how to be a token? We've clearly shown that we appreciate tokenism. So
listen,
so if you can't be a token, then the struggle we'll is, go find again, someone who can.
Like I tell, listen, I tell people, I definitely know I'm not even a cup of tea. I'm a cup of Jameson. And
you're not everyone's cup of Jameson.
But here's the thing. Jameson is what it is, right?
Right.
Don't come sipping the Jameson if you wanted a cup of tea, because this ain't that. And my thing is that you smelled it
across the room.
I was going to say, when you stand up and try and walk, you know what you had.
I turned. So interestingly enough, my first time I actually turned my contract down for that reason, because it really felt like a lot of the buzzwords. I'm like, I don't do that. Like, oh, DEI. And we did a survey and now we're going to hire you and you're going to be one of, and I'm like, so the first, I kind of got, follow your first mind, because I went and I turned the contract down. I said, nope, called my mom. I was like, she was giving me very weird, like, I'm liberal. But I married a Democrat. My second marriage, like this is in the, like it, well, let me not go too
that's
far.
That's just dialogue
that.
From Get Out. Like,
but
no.
This is in my interview. This is my first interview. See, this is me being too nice and trying to save the world. And I've thought about it. My friend's like, oh, no. You'll be able, because you went to school in that type of environment. I think that's it. And Jesus Christ. Dang. I mean, Lord. I mean, as I say, I don't feel blindsided by much, but I'm like, you didn't think HBC hit Coach Hicks, me. I was like, okay. Yeah, it felt like Get Out. Like, I felt like I was waiting for, like, I'm like, cover my ears to make sure there was no teacup being stirred. That's how weird it was. I'm like, lady, I told you. And you're like, no, I promise you. Well, anyway, cup of Jameson.
There we go. All right. Well, thank you guys. And for those of you that want a cup of Jameson or some culture and code, we'll have all the links in the show notes here. You can find them on the Twitter. If you Google Coding with Culture, like, you're at the top of the page, right?
I think so. Yeah, I feel like I've gotten there. There's nobody else yet.
Yeah. Awesome. So go ahead and do that and support them. And we just thank you again for coming. We appreciate you coming on. And as we always say at the end, stay unprofessional.
Oh, all right. I like, yes.
Thank you. Thanks.
Have a good one.
Thank you, and stay unprofessional. Stay unprofessional.
Stay unprofessional.